Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. Obstruction of justice is a crime. Subverting justice strikes at the roots of civilization. Lying is central to obstruction and is often part of the original crime. Take Bernie Madoff.
It's one of the most shocking stories I've ever reported. I mean, I went into this thinking Madoff must have been a genius lawyer because he survived four SEC investigations while running the world's biggest Ponzi scheme.
For decades.
And part of the problem, clearly, is they, you know, the lower-level investigators, he was a terrible liar. He was inconsistent. He would tell the story to one person one day. Sometimes the same investigator, he'd totally change his story. Are options part of the model? One day no, one day yes. Wait a minute, didn't you just say that they were? No, I never said that. I mean, the guy is hopping up and down saying he's committing perjury, he's lying. They wouldn't refer the case to the Justice Department for further investigation. Why? I mean, I think part of that is what happens when even law enforcement itself comes to the view that, oh, well, everyone's doing it, you know, so why would we single out this guy when everyone else is getting away with it? And just kind of accepting it and shrugging, which is a terrible state of affairs in and of itself. But why, even if they weren't going to refer a perjury case, why they couldn't uncover the fact that he's running a huge Ponzi scheme is truly astonishing.
James Stewart tells the stories of four convicted criminals, convicted of lying under oath. The complicity of lawyers, regulators, corporations, the media, and of their gullible and dishonest supporters enabled those crimes. When justice is perverted and obstructed by willful lying, democracy is imperiled. Pulitzer Prize winner Stewart argues that civilization itself cannot be sustained on a diet of lies. James Stewart, over the years and years, I've had a number of friends who have said to me, looking at the America and what they consider a state of decline, saying, well, the problem is greed. And the ethicists are known to say, well, greed is the queen of the vices. And then you throw up your hands and say, well, there's nothing you can do. You don't understand humans. You've given me a foothold, traction, to say yes and, rather than, if that is the case, and I think it's arguable, there is a remedy, and the remedy is in truthfulness.
Yes, you know, I don't think anyone, at least in this country, resents people's success. In fact, they celebrate it. They love to see that. And that includes financial success as well as success in many other areas, with the caveat that they have to feel it was the product of fair play. That someone didn't cheat their way to the top. And I think when people start lying to get somewhere, when they start lying to achieve something, and in fact, when they're already successful and celebrated, and then they lie to maintain their status, or for any number of other reasons, I think that's profoundly unsettling to most people, especially when the lies are, in a way, they sort of insult everyone's intelligence. I mean, you know, well, we can get into some of these examples, but it's pretty obvious that these statements are false, and yet they expect everyone to swallow and sweep it under the rug and agree and enable them to keep doing this. And I think that is corrosive. People do resent that.
Quote a lawyer talking about a conspiracy of dunces, which was not, I think, intended to be descriptive of his clients, but by your representation, it was functionally descriptive of his clients.
Well, yeah, isn't that amazing? That was the lawyer for Martha Stewart and her stockbroker, Peter Bukanovic. And they're a good illustration of this phenomenon because they were both, I mean, Martha Stewart, of course, is a huge celebrity and a billionaire, but the stockbroker was also very accomplished, very well-paid, respected, well-educated. And the lawyer's argument was that the lies they told were so bad, the conspiracy they put together was so inept that how could people who were that successful, that intelligent, and that well-educated do it? So he was trying to say, well, they couldn't have done it because they're too smart to have done something like that. But in all the cases in this book, people have said, well, who's the best liar? And the real question is, who's the worst liar? Because they're all bad. The only question is, who's the worst? And these lies, they were clumsy. And yet, I think that's the hubris that goes with
this. The hubris, exactly.
They didn't even bother to come up with a good story. They didn't think they needed to.
That's insulting to everybody.
It is to everyone.
Particularly to the justice system. I mean, Paula's word, I mean, she looks at it. Justice to me is so central in this. And the, how to say, the efforts, the extraordinary efforts and resources that it went into thwarting or attempting to thwart justice. I mean, I know about it, but when you read about it in detail, when you hear people's words, what they said, how they tried to rationalize it, it's simply appalling.
Yes, I think it's infuriating. It's a theme that courses through this whole book. And just to cite the Martha Stewart example, she was convicted of lying. She deserved to be convicted. The evidence is overwhelming. Yet, to this day, she goes around saying, one, that she's innocent. Well, I guess that's her prerogative.
It's her story.
But she doesn't stop there. She's saying she was persecuted because she's a successful woman, undermining confidence in the integrity of the judicial system. And that is a huge lie. Believe me, when you actually see the facts here, she was not persecuted. She was treated with kid gloves because she was a successful woman. And you can certainly make the argument that she got off easy because she was a successful woman.
You also... Doug Fanuel.
Fanuel.
Thank you. I couldn't understand the conspiracy of dunces. I mean, some of it made a little sense, but his analysis of that that you include at the end is, to me, makes sense of it. These people were talking past one another.
Exactly.
Nobody was listening. Yeah.
Well, it seems to be. I mean, and it's, you know, reading something like this, you try to extract. Are there any generalities? Are there patterns here that make sense? And an awful lot of it is these people just don't listen. They seem to be absorbed in their own worlds and themselves and ignore everything else.
Amazingly. Well, that is a theme, I think, that emerges in the book. When I started the reporting for this, one of the big mysteries to me was, why would people like Martha Stewart, who's so successful, so wealthy, so acclaimed, with so much to lose, why would they, of all people, lie under oath, commit a felony, risk losing, if not everything, a tremendous amount? And that baffled me. By the time I finished, which took several years of reporting and immersing myself in these cases, I came 180 degrees the other way. I came to the conclusion that actually people like this are probably more likely to lie under oath than the rest of us. And one of the reasons is that they never listen to anyone. They don't listen to their lawyers, they don't listen to the people who work for them, and they don't have to. And to the extent that they do listen, they're usually only hearing what people think they want to hear or believe. So there are repeated examples in these stories where they make the most preposterous assertions when someone around them should have stood up and said, wait a minute, this is crazy, this doesn't make any sense at all. And they would just nod and smile and... I would call them enablers.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't act in a vacuum. And people who are celebrated, wealthy, powerful, there are many people around them who have a vested interest in telling them what they want to hear and keeping that golden goose laying the eggs. Bernard Madoff is certainly one of the amazing examples.
I have to say, one set of enablers seemed to be the lawyers that were involved.
Well, I went to law school myself, and I distinctly remember a section of the Code of Professional Responsibility that says lawyers should not knowingly allow a client to lie.
That's unambiguous.
It's unambiguous. And yet, especially in the criminal defense bar, you see people, I mean, all these lies under oath took place when there were highly paid lawyers sitting at their side. And they don't interrupt these depositions, these interrogations. They don't say, oh, wait a minute, maybe we need a little break here. And there are a few exceptions of lawyers in here who do behave quite honorably. But the majority of them, I think, are in the enabling category. They seem to think that with their guidance, their clients are going to get away with it. And so they don't stop because they had to have known that these statements were lies.
James Stewart has written Tangled Webs, Tangled Indeed. We'll be back in just a moment to explore some of the stories behind these larger, very important truths when we return with James Stewart. Be with us. Tangled tangled webs, tangled indeed. James B. Stewart, not to be confused with Jimmy Stewart, James B. Stewart.
Well, you do bear a little resemblance.
Yes, you do. You're tall and handsome.
I think we're all related.
Yes, indeed. All of you Scotsmen. The stories that you tell in Tangled Webs, back to my greed, you can't say greed without arrogance in these stories. And the arrogance is just astounding.
The arrogance, and I guess it goes hand in hand with self-absorption. One reason I called it Tangled Webs was to show it's not just about the central characters, they're very important, but all the people that are drawn into the vortex by their lives, and then that's what becomes so complex. And to me, the impact of this is so vast. But the hubris, the self-absorption, we were talking about Martha Stewart. Some people have said, oh, well, she's back to being a celebrity. Maybe she went to jail for a few months. She paid a fine, but she's fine. Well, you could argue about that, but nevertheless, the people who were swept into the story around her are not fine. And I think one of the most poignant examples was the young assistant to her stockbroker named Douglas Faneuil. And he was swept into the story, and he initially lied to protect them, and then to his credit, he ended up telling the truth.
And that is a rare moment
in this book. He had the courage, he had the integrity, he knew he couldn't live with himself if he held his hand in line under oath. But he suffered tremendously for it. His career, he'll never work on Wall Street again. Does Martha Stewart care that his life was destroyed? No. She even claimed testimony she couldn't remember his name. She didn't, she denied ever having talked to him when actually he placed the stock order. He was just collateral damage to be swept out of his path. Or take Barry Bonds, who was convicted just recently of obstruction of justice and who clearly lied under oath. His trainer went to jail for him. He first lied about it. Then he refused to talk. And for Barry Bonds, he went to jail. And I'm thinking he was obviously, I think, in a misguided way, showing loyalty to Barry Bonds. But should loyalty be a two-way street with these people? With these kinds of characters, the loyalty only goes one way. It's from others to them. There's never any reciprocal loyalty. I mean, why would Barry Bonds let his trainer go to jail? Why didn't he come forward? And friend. Why didn't he come forward and say, look, Greg, go in and tell the truth. I believe I'm innocent. I believe the facts will vindicate me. But you go in and give the testimony. You tell the truth. Don't go to jail. Go in there and testify. Did he ever say anything like that? No. And in his grand jury testimony, he gives some, I think, very revealing testimony where he said, if I'm in a position to use other people, well, I'm going to use them.
And then he did.
And there's no compunction about this. In the political arena, you see it with Scooter Libby. The loyalty all runs to the top, to Vice President Cheney. He didn't tell his assistant to go tell the truth and let the chips fall where they will.
He being Cheney.
Yes. And then in the Madoff case, there's a poignant example where he still says that no one else knew about this scheme, which is just one of his continuing lies. But he brought in this young fellow, Frank DiPasquale, who was a college dropout and a teenager when he went to work for Madoff. And he started showering him with money and perks. And gradually, slowly but surely, he drew him into the Ponzi scheme. And he became the big executor. He kept all the records. He worked the computer. Madoff couldn't even use a computer. He did all of this. And he pleaded guilty. He'll be sentenced. But, he was an impressionable teenager when he came to Madoff. Does Madoff care that he ended up ruining his life and his family's lives? No. None of these people show any remorse for what they did.
We talked
recently. That's called being a sociopath, isn't it?
Well, it's a quality of a sociopath. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't feel qualified to say what these people are. But certainly the having no kind of inner moral compass of right or wrong is a quality of a sociopath. Being able to lie effectively is a hallmark of a sociopath. And I think what we see in society is that whether they're clinically diagnosed as a sociopath or not, many people, and many successful people, display some sociopathic qualities, including a willingness.
That's considered a sickness.
Well, and it should be.
Except when it's considered a sign of success. Unfortunately, we have created an environment in which those two are very easily confused.
We used to do a lot of consulting with big companies, and invariably, the higher up you got, the closer one got to what is known as the reptilian brain, that being way back here, that being that which keeps you breathing without having to think about every breath, but it means that the emotional system is gone, thereby empathy is gone, and the cognitive system is gone, which means you don't think, you're just absolutely out for yourself.
Right.
That seems to be what you're talking about.
What you get is the ability, you know, the very, very constrained ability to rationalize.
Yeah.
Piled on top of the reptilian brain. I mean, this is, you know, it's basically metaphorical, but it's an interesting,
it's a real bad rap for the reptiles.
It's a way to look at it. Is you know, and it shows up in this. These people rationalize the most absurd things, and apparently, at least in some cases, they're successfully rationalizing it to themselves. Mm-hmm. I think some of them, clearly some of them, at least at time, did not know they were lying.
Well,
No telling.
I agree that seems hard to believe,
it's hard to believe.
So consistent, and it is consistent with their personality.
And it's not a defense.
Oh, no.
It's certainly not a defense. I also think it's troubling in that a number of these cases, it wasn't enough to just lie and then to lie about lying and to cover it up. Some of these people went so far as to point the finger at others and falsely accuse other people of doing things that they
Scooter Libby
were not
comes
the case.
To mind.
Scooter Libby comes to mind. Martha Stewart is claiming, you know, that she was persecuted for being a successful woman. But there's a lawyer in the Barry Bonds case. And this, to me, is a particularly compelling story because lawyers have to be the first line of defense against perjury. They are officers of the court.
Right.
They take this oath. They're not supposed to let people give false testimony. So he leaked these grand jury transcripts. There was an investigation into that was a violating the law in and of itself. And he signed a written affidavit saying, I did not leak the transcripts. He lied under oath, denying that he was the source for that. Then he turned around and he pointed the finger at others saying, oh, I think they leaked. First he says the prosecutors leaked. Then when that didn't work, he said, oh, one of his own clients was probably the source. So he's frantically trying to deflect blame by accusing others of what he very well knew that he had done.
You know,
he's a lawyer.
And then, when he finally fessed up, he blamed alcohol and cocaine.
Right.
Yes. And, you know, it's curious that when I interviewed this person who worked very closely with him and had actually, in the end, blew the whistle on him, he said that to his knowledge, he never really did violate cocaine or alcohol, no more than, you know, anyone else in the general population. So that's just, I guess that's now the standard fallback. You check into the Betty Ford Clinic, or you blame it on drugs and alcohol, and then supposedly, oh, then everything is all right.
I want to go back to something you said earlier. You're talking about that role of a mentor. We did a program a week ago with Bill Holstein, who's written about the next American economy. It's an interesting subject.
He's a financial reporter.
He addresses it. You probably know him. And one of the things he points towards is the importance of mentoring in the process of developing a workforce that is appropriate to the work to be done. And it got me thinking, everybody talks about mentors, assuming that it is a uniformly good thing. And what you point to, it concerns me because not everybody's a nice guy. Not every mentor is mentoring in a way that is, let us say, legal, honorable, ethical, reflects high moral or ethical standards.
Does Bernie Madoff come to mind?
Well, that's why I mentioned that, because this mentoring piece is very dangerous. And actually, you can see it all across what you've written about.
Well, I think that's a good point. And one of the reasons that these stories, I think, are so significant and serious is that all of these characters are role models, and that we're social beings. We look at the behavior of others to shape our own conduct. We start by looking at our parents. We look at our teachers. In the workplace, we look to those we're working with, our superiors, our mentors in many cases, for clues to how you behave to make your way through life. And when you suddenly have lying at this high level, at this scale, and then when you see these role models pressure the people under them, not just by setting a bad example, but by actually pressuring them to get on the team and perpetuate the lie, you see other people being pushed into it, in some cases at their own peril.
Soldier on the battlefield is the one that gets my attention, coming from Dick Cheney, which I found appalling, I mean, just vile,
Well, and saying it to Bush that he should pardon the guy because he's a soldier on the battlefield.
I also found it to be damning evidence that he had made promises that Bush undercut.
Well, you know, one of the mysteries in this story, which was involved the outing of the identity of a covert CIA agent, was who ordered this harebrained, you know, PR scheme in the first place.
This conspiracy of dunces.
And Scooter Libby, we know now, was one of the people vigorously trying to get the press to expose her identity. He never admitted that, even though he's chief of staff to the vice president, he never admitted that the vice president was the source of that. However, here's the evidence. I mean, there were handwritten notes in Scooter Libby's handwriting in which the vice president dictated to him the information that Valerie Plame was a covert agent. A very short time after that meeting, Libby is out meeting with Judith Miller, a New York Times reporter, vigorously trying to get her to write a story. That's incident one. Incident two, he and Dick Cheney are alone in a cabin of Air Force Two together. They both testify that it's possible that Cheney told him to leak her identity in this flight, but he doesn't. Neither one could remember. Libby gets off the plane. He goes right into the terminal at Andrews Air Force Base, and in the terminal, he gets on the phone and starts speed dialing reporters, trying to get them to expose the identity of Valerie Plame. Now, can't we all put two and two together there? That sequence of events. I do not believe Scooter Libby was freelancing this breach of national security. It's so obvious that Cheney told him to do that. And then, of course, Cheney's claiming he was a soldier on the battlefield, I think, reinforces that. But what is so pernicious about that, to me, is that it elevates loyalty over the obligation to obey the law. And if loyalty is a supreme virtue, then those who have the power, the strongest, in a position to command loyalty, will rule. We will revert to the law of the jungle. It's no wonder that this is the code of organized crime.
You call it tribalism.
It is. Exactly.
And organized crime, you said organized crime.
Right. I didn't hear you say that.
Well, that's the law of organized crime. That's, you know, when Greg Anderson, Barry Bonds' trainer, got out of jail on one of the many occasions he was in there for contempt of court, for refusing to testify, all the inmates gathered around and gave him a standing ovation. Now, that to me pretty much says it all. This is the law of the prison yard, that loyalty trumps every citizen's obligation to tell the truth when sworn to do so.
There is another level to this that makes it all the more egregious, if that's possible. Then you get George W. Bush condoning this behavior, the person who is at the pinnacle of the government that is representing me, my government, we the people being sovereign. You get Bush, who won't pardon him, but he condones it, literally condones this behavior by saying, oh, well, but he doesn't have to go to jail. What does that tell the world?
I was appalled by this. I mean, a democracy cannot function if we do not have truth at the highest levels of our government, number one. And secondly, the president is the highest law enforcement officer. He must obey the law. And if not, then where are we? But what happened?
And the answer is, where are we? We are.
We're in serious trouble. But, you know, Cheney wanted him to pardon Libby for obvious reasons. And so Bush actually convened a group of lawyers to review all the evidence to see if there was in any way he might have not gotten a fair trial, was wrongly convicted. And the committee concluded that no, he was not wrongly convicted. There was a massive amount of evidence. So Bush said, no, I'm not going to pardon him. But then, as you point out, he commuted the sentence. And now, what is the difference? The prosecutor was apoplectic, was very upset about this. Because exactly as you say, he essentially condoned perjury by saying he did not have to serve his sentence. No wonder, there's a U.S. senator in my book, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, quoted as saying, the eve of Libby's indictment, she said on national television, well, I hope they indict him on a real crime and not some technicality like perjury. And, you know, that is horrifying to me because perjury is a crime. It is a felony. It's been a crime since this country was founded. It was a crime in medieval England. It was a crime in ancient Rome because the obligation to tell the truth in a court is one of the planks of civilization.
We're going to be right back with James Stewart, and there's so much more to talk about. Please join us when we
come
back.
None of which we care about, right?
No, none of which we care about. Tangled webs, how false statements, why not lies? Why false statements are undermining America, from Martha Stewart to Bernie Madoff to you, and we will hope that you'll be with us when we come back. We are pleased and distraught, pleased to be with James Stewart, who has written Tangled Webs. He's talking about false statements, not lies, because false statements...
False statements are a crime under the criminal code. They include perjury, a lie told under oath, and false statements told to an investigative body of the U.S. government. Lies, we all know, occupy a very broad continuum from criminal lying, which is what I'm writing about, to very serious lying with devastating consequences, all the way, let's face it, to the innocuous white lie.
And it's important to say all of these people, every single one of them, had a constitutional alternative.
Yes.
It's called?
The Fifth Amendment. No United States citizen ever has to tell a lie under oath. You can simply say, I'm not going to answer that question. I exercise my right under the Fifth Amendment. They all could have done this.
So they have real options. They choose.
In that context, there is early on, when this came up, Bush said, nobody in the White House did anything. If they did, we'll fire them.
Right.
That's contradictory. He asserted out mm-hmm. front, which one of the things that I've found... Mm-hmm. And it goes to the underlying, what the broad cultural problems that we're faced with. The first thing he asserts in Washington, which is just awash in people leaking, it's the way business is done. He asserts with virtually no evidence than his say-so, his faith story, if mm-hmm. you will, that no one in this administration did that, which was implausible on his face. And then he undercuts what he just said by saying, and of course, whoever did, if anybody did, we'll fire them.
And then he doesn't.
Which is it? And the initial statement was obviously implausible. But again, it goes to the reflexive. And a lot of this seems to be cultural. You know, we watch too many Perry Masons, or not enough Perry Masons. And I think... I sort of started paying serious attention during the Watergate hearings, mm-hmm. and it's when we first started to learn how to parse words in neat little pieces so we could assert, as Clinton did, argue about the meaning of is. Mm-hmm. Some of this seems to be profoundly embedded. We've come to expect it.
And tolerate it.
And I say all that in the context of what Bush had said. Nobody notices that. Nobody noticed it at the time. And it seems that we have sort of become inured to this, to the kinds of things you're talking about. That's devastating. You said that will kill civilization.
It's appalling. And I was very disappointed as I got into the story with President Bush's conduct. And I had no axe to grind against him. In fact, if anything, I felt he'd probably been unfairly persecuted by the press. How it was so bad. Maybe there was another side of the story. But he did pledge to the American people he wouldn't tolerate leaking a national security breach like this. And one of the revelations in my book is that Karl Rove, his top assistant and dear friend, who was never indicted in this scandal, there was plenty of evidence. He came so close to being indicted, but the prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, chose not to. And instead, he sent a letter to President Bush summarizing the confidential testimony, the serious allegations, the evidence against Karl Rove that, A, he had breached the security by leaking the name, and then, secondly, he had not been truthful about it. And specifically, he had not been truthful to President Bush when he asked him point blank if he was a source for the column. And yet, he never heard a reply from that. Bush did nothing. After pledging to the American people he wouldn't tolerate this behavior, it's exactly what he did.
And it was virtually proven to him exactly what he had said was the case.
This was a very, very serious step for the special counsel to take. And then, again, adding even more lies on top of all the many that were told. So many Republicans piled on to this, attacked not Bush, not Libby, not Rove, but the special counsel, because they said, oh, he's an attack dog, he's obviously partisan, even though he's not even registered in either party, he's overzealous. If there's any criticism that can be leveled against him, is that he was not zealous enough. He could easily have gotten an indictment against both Karl Rove in the White House and Richard Armitage in the State Department.
So why didn't he?
I understand why he didn't. It was, it's a complicated story. I think you see it in the pages of the book. In the end, it was a judgment call. The case against Libby was overwhelming. The case against Rove and Armitage were a little more ambiguous, and I will say on behalf of both of them that unlike Libby, they corrected their testimony.
Now, and they had lied.
In my view, they had lied. But nevertheless, when the evidence surfaced that they had lied, their lawyers and they themselves went to the special counsel and said, okay, I'll go back. I made a mistake. I want to correct the record. That didn't help Doug Fanuel. He changed his story and corrected the record. He had to plead guilty to a crime. But nevertheless, they got away with it, which is a double standard that I think is also troubling.
I think that's
better than Libby did.
That's an important step along the way to say, wait a minute, isn't justice blind? Doesn't it apply equally to everybody?
Well, look, I love that ideal that we are a nation in which all are equal before the law. And I thank God, at least I hope we're still aspiring to it. But have we gotten there, even close to it? Well, you can't read this book and feel that everyone is treated equally. The less powerful, the less wealthy, they get the book thrown at them. Celebrated professional athletes. I mean, you think Barry Bonds is the only person who lied in that steroid investigation? That's probably a bad metaphor, but that's a World Series of lying. Almost every professional athlete, baseball, track, football, called before the grand jury, immunized, no crime at all unless they lied. And then many of them subsequently recanted and finally, under threat of prosecution, told the truth. And they... No consequences whatsoever. They're back playing. They didn't get anything thrown at them. Doug Fanuel, a 26-year-old, low-paid assistant to a stockbroker, just hoping to make his start on Wall Street, he changes his story. First, they say he has to plead guilty to 2 felonies, which would almost certainly have involved a jail term. And ultimately, he still had to plead to a misdemeanor and be banned from the securities industry for life, essentially for telling the truth.
He didn't. I mean, my understanding is it wasn't so much an overt commission as he did not tell everything. He didn't do what all these other people did, which was say something was the case when it was not in fact the case. He just didn't say anything.
He omitted critical information. And actually, when you see the crime of false statement, it says misstatement, a deliberate misstatement, or a material omission of irrelevant fact. So it is a
crime. So he was guilty.
To withhold it. But I think we can all agree that in the scheme of bad behavior, fabricating and falsifying something is one thing, and simply withholding a complete account is lesser on the scale. But nevertheless, he had to pay the price.
There is something in this book. We went past it earlier on, and I went past it 8 or 10 times before it finally soaked in, this notion of obstruction of justice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's become a phrase. We say obstruction of justice, right? And we hear it so much that it's. And I don't think most of us. And I don't. Yeah, it's a crime, but there are a whole lot of crimes. Obstructing justice is a crime at a different level. That goes. I mean, it's a metaphysical crime. It goes to the absolute foundation, and you make this point fairly consistently, and that's what helped me finally see it. It goes to, you simply cannot have a community, you can't have a society, you can't have a political entity, you can't have a civilization, and you certainly can't have governments if people routinely or occasionally even obstruct justice.
You can have them, but they're going to be awful.
They're going to be unjust, and the...
Right.
What do people eventually do in an unjust society? You see, they revolt. They're willing to give up their lives to try to achieve a just society. Thank goodness. We revolted, to found this country against what we believe to be an unjust society. And you see this, the effect of perjury and lies, what it does to the judicial system. It brings it to its knees. Again, I mentioned there was so much lying in the steroids investigation. Barry Bonds lied before the grand jury in 2003. He kept taking the steroids. He went on to hit more home runs. He won the home run crown, which was taken away from Hank Aaron and given to him. He was finally brought to trial a few weeks ago, more than 8 years after the alleged false statements. Why
and several
is
that? Million dollars.
And many millions of dollars of our taxpayer money. And why is that? Because all the witnesses in the case were lying. You cannot bring any kind of a case when everyone is giving false testimony and refusing to testify. That case, if Greg Anderson, his trainer, had given truthful testimony, that case would have been over in 6 weeks, not 8.5 years.
Well, and the last time I looked, Bud Selig, the commissioner of baseball, had decided that even after the conviction, the record stands. Now, we're in Atlanta. We're a little partial to Hank Aaron, but that's beside the point in this context. That impresses me as, one, outrageous, given the conviction. And Major League Baseball is not constrained by justice.
or much of anything else.
Well, they don't have to follow the rules. I mean, they didn't have to wait till then. I mean, the behavior was so manifestly egregious that they could have at any time. And instead, today, as far as I know, the record still stands.
He cheated. Barry Bonds cheated. He lied about it, and he was convicted of obstruction of justice. And Bud Selig said that he said, quote, "There's not enough evidence to take the crown away
to
from
give it
him.
Back to an honorable man."
Yes, exactly.
Who had earned it?
I know. And people say, "Oh, well, it's just sports." You know, first of all, sports is an unbelievably important metaphor that young people look to, and secondly,
that's how we justify it most of the time.
We do, and also talk about unjust. People say, "Oh, everybody's taking steroids." No, everyone was not taking steroids. The home run crown holder might have been taking steroids. Hank Aaron didn't take steroids. To let him keep it is not only unjust in that Barry Bonds get it; it's committing an injustice to the person who deserves it. And I think that infuriates fair-minded people.
We're going to be back in a minute with James Stewart, who brings fair-mindedness together in four incredibly breathtaking examples, entangled webs, how false statements, a crime, are undermining America, from Martha Stewart to Bernie Madoff. Be with us when we come back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. It is a pleasure and a pain and a pleasure to be with James Stewart, who brings us to the leading edge with the stories that he tells in Tangled Webs. There is a book called The Tangled Wing that is written by an anthropologist whose name is Melvin Connor, happens to be a friend. It talks about the human animal, where we are now is what he was going to call the book when he revised it completely. And he says that it's a tangled wing because we have not evolved fully yet. We're still coming out of our chrysalis. Well, these tangled webs seem to me to be a step backward, a devolution, not an evolution, that we are permitting behavior that we have already, as a species, said, that ain't right. You can't do that. And yet, as you describe all four of these individuals and the very clear story that, as an excellent, superlative reporter, you give us hook, line, and sinker, if you will, that this is unacceptable behavior. And yet...
Well, I don't know what your friend the anthropologist would say, but it does seem that we have to relearn these basic truths every so often, that you would think that history would have established this. I mean, it's in the Ten Commandments. I mean, depending on the translation, either thou shalt not lie, thou shalt not bear false witness. This came down in the tablets from the mountain. I mean, obviously, long before us, human beings had figured out that this is essential to civilization. If we're going to rise above the survival of the fittest, if we're going to have a real civilization, if we're going to have anything resembling a just society, this has to be a central element of it.
But the survival of the fittest is not Darwinian. That happens to be Herbert Spencer. That's a whole different thing. That's social Darwinism. And in fact, when you look at real Darwin, the real deal of what works in evolution, it isn't the cheaters and the liars and those who have gotten away with the bad stuff. It's those who are most functional, those who can be support. And the reason humans have done so well is that we do cooperate and we do push out to the sides people who are breaking the rules.
Right. Well, and I think we, as a society, establish notions of right and wrong and moral and immoral behavior. And then as a group, we have to sanction those. And I think this is where there has been a problem in modern society with the obligation to tell the truth, that we're too willing to sort of look the other way. We're too willing to stand up and cheer when Barry Bonds hits his, you know, all-time home run, even though we know he's been cheating by using steroids and then he lied about it before a grand jury. We're too willing to go to the voting place and vote for a party that whose president has just lied repeatedly to the American public. You know, we're too willing to, you know, keep, you know, ignore the fact that, Martha Stewart committed perjury and then insists that she didn't. And by the way, I think there's redemption, you know, but I believe step one is you have to admit it and ask for forgiveness and then move forward, because that, you know, reinforces the broad value that has just been transgressed. And I think we all bear some responsibility with our friends, with our colleagues, with our coworkers, and with our children to make sure that we send a clear message that this behavior is intolerable and it's wrong and we're not going to stand for it.
Well, to go back to Darwin, it's not just humans. Franz de Waal at Yerkes and lots of others have done work that's basically social animals have rules. Mm-hmm. If you break the rules, then there are consequences.
That's what's so outrageous to me, is that the lack of consequences with
well,
these
and,
things.
Well, and I think it leads to a degenerated culture, a corrosive and a corrupted culture. You see it now, and cheating seems to be just sort of built in at all levels of education. It obviously is happening in sports. Politics is just wall to wall with it. We have functionally a network which is committed to
television and cable network
misrepresenting reality, the reality that anybody who had a sense, how to say, a sense of, that the Enlightenment was relevant. I mean, we are just awash in this, and it is ultimately destructive. It's probably the single greatest threat to our civilization and this nation.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, again, you mentioned sanctioning it. People need to be deterred. They need to be encouraged on the one hand, and they need to be deterred on the other.
Isn't that what laws are about?
And that's what laws are all about. And
well,
then you
and the
see,
enforcement of them.
And the enforcement of them. But you see in these stories, I put in the book in chronological order for a variety of reasons. I put them in this order. But in the Barry Bonds case, which came after Martha Stewart, one of the defendants says, well, you know, I looked at Martha Stewart and I saw she got a few months in jail, and that didn't seem to be so bad for her. And now she seems fine. So I thought, well, that doesn't seem so bad. It's worth taking the risk. And then another character in there, the lawyer who lied, his lawyer goes before the judge and says, I think you should, you know, give him probation. He shouldn't have to go to jail. And the judge said, well, why shouldn't he? And he said, well, President Bush commuted Scooter Libby's sentence. He didn't have to go to jail. So why should my client have to go to jail? The judge said, well, tell your client to write President Bush and ask him to commute his sentence. And he did make him go to jail. But nevertheless, the perception of many of the people in my story who are lying under oath is, well, the consequences are going to be very minor.
And it keeps building on itself. I saw a headline today in May of 2011, today, that said that Europeans come to this country so they can lie, cheat, and steal, that they'll do stuff here they'd never get away with or even try to get away with in Europe because, it's America. You can do anything here. That in the
including
world,
the head of the MIF,
right.
IMF, apparently.
Well, yes, and I, you know, look, this is an issue. I think when you have President Bush commuting, condoning perjury, and you know, to be nonpartisan about it, we had a president, Bill Clinton, who committed perjury, only grudgingly acknowledged it and has never really apologized for it. Now, those are back-to-back United States presidents,
and George Bush put before him. Commuting the sentences of the Iran.
Right.
I mean, this goes on. Yeah. In my adult life, this has been a fairly consistent thing.
That's before we talk about Richard Nixon. I mean,
we have appalling examples at the top of our government, and that's why I think we need somebody to stand up and say, this is not acceptable behavior, and it's not going to be tolerated in America.
There's also another piece of this, and that is the regular breakdown of the profession that is lawyers in this process. When the people who are agents of the court which essentially makes them functionally our agents. As citizens, they work for us, representing this key ingredient in our society, which is justice. When they not only do appalling things with almost no consequences. I mean, the belief seems to be, and we've seen this lots of other places, that if a law, I mean, honestly, I reading some of this, I thought I was watching Boston Legal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it had that level.
Way over the top.
Well, it was over the top, but it was, in some cases, even more absurd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems we have a serious problem in legal education, but also in enforcement within the legal profession itself.
Well, the legal profession does a terrible job of enforcing its own code of responsibility. The number of instances that get referred for disciplinary action, only the most egregious cases tend to get referred. It's self-governance. It's self-policing. And
which
I guess we
works.
Shouldn't be so surprised that that doesn't work all that effectively. But there are very, very few. I didn't uncover any examples of a lawyer being referred to a disciplinary body for knowingly allow a client to make a false statement in court.
That's appalling.
And you spend years looking at this.
Yes. And again, going to the enforcement issue, I asked, the Madoff example is so shocking to me because he lied, he was a terrible liar, the SEC investigators knew he was lying, they did nothing. And when I asked the SEC Inspector General, had the SEC ever referred a case for perjury to the Justice Department, he said he couldn't think of a single one.
Just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, you introduced Nero. And it's not the guy that I would thought was the bad guy. It was the Northeast Regional Office of the SEC.
That would be the Security and Exchange Commission, SEC.
As bad as this other stuff is, the absolute failure, and this creates a whole other set of problems, which has to do with people's attitude about government, which is basically their attitude about it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I can't characterize it any other way than just incompetence. Now, whether it's ignorance, stupidity, laziness, whatever, the performance of Nero in the Madoff examinations, ersatz examinations, I would object if a 12-year-old was as inept as these people were. How do you account for that?
Higher up you got, the more inept they got.
And, oh, by the way, most of these people are still in place. And the ones that aren't in place seem to think they were persecuted.
It's one of the most shocking stories I've ever reported. I mean, I went into this thinking Madoff must have been a genius liar because he survived four SEC investigations while running the world's biggest Ponzi scheme.
For decades.
And part of the problem, clearly, is the lower-level investigators, he was a terrible liar. He was inconsistent. He would tell the story to one person one day. Sometimes the same investigator, he'd totally change his story. Are options part of the model? One day no, one day yes. Wait a minute, didn't you just say that they were? No, I never said that. I mean, the guy is hopping up and down saying he's committing perjury, he's lying. They wouldn't refer the case to the Justice Department for further investigation. Why? I mean, I think part of that is what happens when even law enforcement itself comes to the view that, oh, well, everyone's doing it, so why would we single out this guy when everyone else is getting away with it? And just kind of accepting it and shrugging, which is a terrible state of affairs in and of itself. But why, even if they weren't going to refer a perjury case, why they couldn't uncover the fact that he's running a huge Ponzi scheme is truly astonishing. I don't know that I can completely explain.
Part of this looks like, I mean, it was Nero. It was the Boston office.
Boston was more aggressive.
Exactly. And there is always the problem of regulatory capture, which again goes to the consequences for the regulators. I mean, somebody who guards the guardians.
Mm-hmm.
And the breakdown in this is, and I'm not sure, has it been fixed? Is there any evidence it's been fixed?
Not at all. In fact, you said most of these people in their jobs, all of them except one, who quit before the scandal broke so she could be at home to take better care of her children.
And feels persecuted.
Yes, exactly. Feels it's unfair that she's been criticized.
James Stewart is with us. We'll be back with him in just a moment. We trust you'll be with us. J. James Stewart has written a riveting book that he calls Tangled Webs. Mr. Stewart, you say so many important things in this book, which, as I have said to you off camera, is a page-turner. It's one of the, holy cow, is this going to get worse, going to get better? I stayed up way too late reading. Among the really important pieces that came through to me loudly and clearly is your statement that the enemy of virtue is indifference.
Right.
That comes very close to somebody who says, the only thing Americans hate worse than a cheater is a snitch.
Right.
How in the world do you get your hands around the indifference that goes with that kind of an attitude, that it's worse to tell somebody is cheating than the cheating itself?
Yeah, I mean, the problem indifference is vast, and how we get at this, I don't know. It's like going around now, like talking about this book and trying to sort of sound the alarm. Because, look, most people, I think, are very decent people. They want to do the right thing. They, if asked, would you ever lie under oath? No, of course not. They would never do that. They don't believe that they would. And yet you see other well-meaning people drawn into these stories. They either end up lying themselves, participating in a lie, enabling it, even though I'm sure if they asked in the abstract, they would have never said they would have done it. Why? Because they're competing virtues. The duty to tell the law, to tell the truth, the obligation to obey the law is coming into conflict with something like loyalty or greed or getting more money. I mean, you see it happening, and that's when the real issues begin. But for many people, what's sad to me about it is that we do have to care about this on some fundamental level, even if it isn't immediately happening to us. We have to, as citizens and members of a community, we have to be able to care about people and incidents that are not what's happening in our own immediate life. And the self-absorption that you see in these characters is not confined, in my experience, only the most celebrated, powerful, wealthy people in the country. It seems to be filtering at an ever lower level. And I can only think that education is a big part of it, and reading is a big part of it, because what happens when you read? You are experiencing things that aren't happening to yourself as vividly as though they were. And I believe that is how we as a culture have always conveyed great truths.
And also, reading as opposed to watching television and lots of other things is interactive. It allows you to be critical. I found myself time and time and again thumbing back in the book to make sure mm-hmm. I had the names right or the circumstances right. Or it turns out the guy came from Drexel Burnham. Oh, I get it. And he's still running an office in the SEC. Is having worked for Drexel Burnham a crime? No. However, when you start putting the pieces together, but I say all that because a book allows you to exercise your critical faculties, and as much as anything, we seem to have lost the ability to do that. It doesn't seem to be taught in schools. We teach people how to take tests. Those are not antithetical, but they're unrelated.
And it's more than just flipping through the headlines of a paper. Right. The sitting down, and it sort of builds on, I think, what Bill was just saying, it's quite different to have been flipping through and, oh, yeah, I saw the headline, and you see these pieces day by day. It's different when you've gone back and you've assembled the pieces and told me the whole story than if I had read every single day's newspaper telling me the pieces. It's different.
Right. I mean, these are all the main stories I tell are celebrated cases. They were covered in the media. Although people who think they already know the story, I would encourage to actually read.
Absolutely, because it's different.
It's very different. But I was saying earlier, I could have written a whole book on each one of these, and maybe they deserve a book. But to me, the power of it comes from the synthesis, from building as you move from one case, and then you begin to see the similarities and the differences, and then the pattern grows, the consequences grow, the tapestry becomes richer, and to me, only by the time you've seen all four of these stories do you get the full scope of the problem.
That is
that we are facing a crisis in this country and that we need to stand up and do something about it. It's not just that what happened in one case, it's what's happening across a wide range of cultural and business fields, and I mean, it's It's media and business in Martha Stewart. It's politics in Bernie Madoff. It's sports and entertainment in Barry Bonds. And it's Wall Street with billions of dollars of losses to innocent victims in Bernie Madoff. So you get a sense of the scope of the problem, the urgency of the problem, the consequences of the problem, and what can be done about it. And to me as a writer, you know, you talk about the reading experience. This to me is so important. I mean, I'm getting a little worked up here on your show, but my my job is not to try to take a club and hit people over the heads and say, you've got to think this is important. I'm an old school adherent to the show, don't tell school of writing. And what I'm trying to do is create the picture, create the information so that readers can synthesize this on their own and draw their own conclusions, whatever they are, because to me, that's how you change hearts and minds.
This is James Stewart. We're going to be back in just a minute, and then Bill can say what it is he was going to say. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, James Stewart, we'll all be back. Join us. A few more minutes with James Stewart, the author of Tangled Webs. Ah, what tangled webs we... Bill Russell?
He just went to work for the New York Times.
I'm going to. I haven't quite started.
Well, soon you will be. But you also write for The New Yorker, which I treat as my newspaper.
I too.
And the reason is they do what you have done, and you write for them as well, which is to take time to think about it.
Imagine.
One of the many challenges we have, we sit here, we've had lots of friends over the years, still have people at senior friends in senior positions at CNN. The problem is the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365 days a year, and they feel like they've always got to be saying something, and they're always saying, and they're not thinking, they're not researching, they're not doing what I think is necessary to present a balanced thoughtful, and I don't mean fair and balanced, and I don't mean two sides of an argument. I mean somebody that has done the research, the thinking, brings expertise, skill, education to the project. Television has let us down
monumentally.
I simply, even to the point I won't watch it, the news portions of it, or any other for that matter. And we're losing our newspapers, which have a spotty record, but they generally have been better sources of news. Everything else aside, we've got a serious problem in the kinds of things you're talking about because we can't get reliable information.
This is bad.
Now, I know you're going to be working for the New York Times soon. How do we fix that? I mean, what do people who are genuinely, who want to be good citizens do?
Well, I think, first of all, we get the media. I was going to say that we deserve, but I don't really want to say that. I think that we get the media that we're willing to support and pay for, mm-hmm. one way or another. And media in this country was historically supported by advertising, and the old advertising model is breaking down with the digital revolution. So I think the question is, are we as citizens going to step up and start actually paying for some of the professional work that leads to in-depth reporting? I'm not here to, you know, fortunately I've had a wonderful career in journalism. I'm not here to say I deserve a raise. But, you know, to take this book, for example, the economics of it are probably insane. It took me over 4 years of work and reporting on this. I don't know how much it'll sell. I mean, it's a roll of the dice. You don't know if people are going to buy it or not. I think the book costs, I don't know, you can get it for $12 to $14 discounted. At an hourly basis, it's probably crazy.
But that's not the metric that should be applied to something about democracy.
No, of course not. I mean, I felt compelled to do this book. I mean, and to me, that's the best thing about journalism is that I sometimes this fire gets lit in me with book projects especially, and there's just no way I cannot do it. And I was writing about the corporate scandals, and I saw the lying and the millions and billions that people were losing as a result of it, lying and by people who were wealthy and successful and educated. And so this whole idea took root, and I felt this has got to be my life mission, at least for the next few years. So here I am. But we in this country, we have to support writers. We have to buy books. We have to buy quality media.
And then we have to be skeptical. And that's not the same as cynicism. And boy, this could be, at the end of this book, could be cynicism L Maximus. It doesn't have to be that way. I go back to where I started. Yes, greed is at the root of much of what you describe, which is part of the monetizing of which you speak. This isn't about the money. The next step is, and what do you do about it? You begin with a commitment to justice, to democracy, to truth-telling.
Yeah, and you know, you can't put a price tag on that. I mean, again, going back to the character Doug Faneuil, who I think is so important in here, who initially told a misleading, if not outright false story, who went along with the Martha Stewart, Peter Bogdanovich conspiracy. Ultimately, he couldn't live with himself. And what he has that these other characters don't is his own self-worth, his own sense of personal integrity. And much to my surprise, I gave a talk at the 92nd Street Y a few years ago, and he came up afterwards. He was in the audience. And he said he's been wrestling for years with what he did, that so many people have said, you know, Doug, you were crazy to tell the truth. You should have just kept lying. You would have gotten away with it. And he said, you know, I realized, no, I am better off because I have something. I was put in a situation not of my making, but I have something now, my integrity, that is priceless, and that life is so much better being able to live it honestly than it is having to carry the burden of those falsehoods around.
There's one thing we've not talked about that I just have this burning need. I have this bumper sticker that I have yet to put on the truck. When you have a nation where the Supreme Court justices, in the process of being confirmed, are willing to tell what looks like at least not the whole truth, and that is the ultimate authority within the judicial system, that third part of government, what do you do with Supreme Court justices who are not, some of them demonstrably lied to get confirmed, others have been slip-slidey. What do you do with that?
Well, you've got to take it seriously, and you have to act on the evidence, and there have to be sanctions for the judiciary, maybe especially. I mean, as I said, lawyers and judges are the first line of defense against false statements, and if they are now resorting to them to advance to get where they are, then how can we expect them to hold the line against others? It's a serious problem, and
that calls for a revolution, doesn't it?
You said it.
I said it.
You started to say we get the press we deserve, and then you politely backed away from it. We also get the government we deserve. I mean, the right reason these people are on the Supreme Court is because the Senate confirmed them and a president appointed them. I mean, ultimately, the people are sovereign. We were at an event with some high-level people last week, and everybody was having a grand old time picking on the politicians. The subject was sustainability, but it doesn't matter. We pick on politicians, and they deserve to be picked on. They're failing abysmally just across the board. However, we elected them. And the same is characteristic of the judges. I mean, ultimately, we are responsible as individuals and as communities. And as much as anything, the story I take away from this book is if we're not engaged, if we refuse to serve on juries, if we find excuses for not going down to the courthouse, then we get what we deserve.
Or if we make false statements.
Right. I mean, I hope the simplest thing that emerges from this book, that anyone who reads it, is if you're ever called as a witness, you're ever sworn to tell the truth, it is our moral and civic duty to tell it, whatever the consequences might be, that the truth is the supreme virtue.
Is America becoming a nation of liars? Have advertising, PR, political spin, and ersatz news become the defining standard for our public and private conversations? The small minority of reporters and editors who continue to uncover and truthfully share important stories are valiantly resisting that plague. They deserve our thanks and our support. Bless you, James Stewart. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.